From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, pandemonium in Congress. Fistfights and guns and knives. It's bad in Washington right now for sure, but the Yale historian Joanne Freeman says you should have seen it right before the Civil War. Lawmakers from the South were kind of jerks, certainly bullies, and at some point, Northerners decided they weren't going to take it anymore. Freeman will join us to talk about her book. It's called The Field of Blood. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the decades before the Civil War in this country, there was a lot of fighting going on in Congress. And I don't mean arguing, though there was plenty of that. They were hitting each other, slapping each other. There's a famous case where one congressman caned a colleague. There was a duel where one congressman was killed. Not to mention the times these guys would pull Bowie knives on each other or aim pistols at each other. The Yale historian Joanne Freeman has written a book about this congressional violence. And one of the things she found is that the fighting happened when the American people no longer trusted the institution of Congress to address their rights and their needs. So they wanted their representatives to fight, actually fight for their rights. Joanne Freeman is a professor of history and American studies at Yale University. She also co-hosts a podcast called Backstory. Her new book is called The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War. She joined us from the studios of NPR in New York, and she told us that writing the book, researching all of these stories about violence, was an emotional experience for her, and that there were moments when she had to walk away, try and get some distance from it all.
It wasn't so true when I started the book, but it was very, very true when I ended it. Mm. And that's because I found myself writing about the same dynamic as I was watching in the news.
Yeah.
And so on the one hand, I thought, oh, wow, isn't this fascinating? I'm writing about things and I'm feeling personally the dynamic of them play out in real life, in real time. That should be really wonderfully inspiring for my writing. But I also found myself so emotionally bound up in what was happening now and thus in what was happening then, that it kind of felt at times that there was no escape from what's a pretty brutal news cycle. So I just found myself, it made me very emotional about the present, I suppose I would say, focusing on this moment in our past, so that I did have to a good number of times just sort of walk away from my computer and do something distracting for a while and not think about it.
Yeah, and it must have made you think that if you that at that time, as this is being documented, that the stakes were unclear and it was still very much up in the air what would exactly happen, whether this institution would crumble and fall apart.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, I mean, as a historian and as a historian who, you know, I certainly have never ventured past the Civil War and have spent a lot of time in the early part of the early republic in the late 18th century. One of the most important things to remember, and certainly something I focus on with my students, is it was an experiment in its earliest years. Yeah. No one knew if a republic would work in a world of monarchies.
Right.
And it remained somewhat experimental, a sort of democratic experiment into the antebellum period. So yeah, people didn't know, first of all, the system of government at first, if it would work. And then once it seemed like it might have legs and it might actually survive, then the larger questions and certainly the question of how to cement the Union together was a huge one. And then the question of slavery's place in that decision, you know, obviously rose up to swallow everything else.
It's interesting when you start doing this research and it's amazing when you think about duels and people pulling knives and pistols and punching. And the question, why it is that that story hadn't been told? Why do you think?
I asked myself that question a lot of times in the course of writing the book. And the fact of the matter is there are people who have written about the fact that in the last few years before the Civil War, there was violence in Congress and congressmen were armed.
Yeah.
So a lot of books that you read about the coming of the Civil War will have a paragraph or two or three discussing that. And of course, they also talk about the caning of Charles Sumner in 1856.
Yeah.
But no one has really tried to step back and see the scope and scale. And I think that's for a few reasons. Number one, if you don't expect to find it, you're not going to see it.
Yeah.
It's largely censored out of the period's equivalent of the congressional record.
Mm-hmm.
There's not an enormous amount of press coverage of it until basically the late 1840s or the 1850s. So if I hadn't stumbled across the evidence of it in a person's private correspondence, there's no way I would have known there was a story. I would have thought, as everyone else was thinking, well, there's a handful of these incidents and they tell you something about the culture of the time, period.
But in fact, there was a lot of this kind of thing going on. And one of the things that you mention is that it was a violent time, that congressional violence was a peace with this world. So is that how we behaved as a country in those days?
Well, we were definitely, conditions were often rough. I mean,
yeah.
We were a violent country.
Yeah.
We were a young country, but we were also a violent country. And, you know, people learn in American history some of the ways that we were violent. They know about the genocide of Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the system of slavery is grounded on violence, but there was nativist rioting. There was actually rioting was an ongoing problem. You know, these decades, the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, people were kind of still figuring out the boundaries, I guess, of a democratic politics and really exercising those boundaries. And because the stakes felt increasingly high, kind of like they do now, the fighting became more intense.
In the early days of your research, you write about this memorandum, this confidential memorandum that you came across. Three members of Congress, one from Ohio, one from Michigan, one from Pennsylvania. And it was this moment when all three of them, they were just sick and tired of taking this crap from the Southerners, who tended to be bullies, which we'll get to. And they were going to fight. And I wanted you to say something about this memorandum, because you say when you first read it, it really impacted you. It kind of brought tears to your eyes, I think you said.
Yeah, it did. It did, because, I mean, I think generally speaking, often people don't think of the study of history as something that's bound up with emotion.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they
yeah.
think of it as facts and people.
Yeah.
And not only is it something that has emotion to it, but emotions are part of how history unfolds. But certainly when I was beginning the project, I wasn't thinking about emotion at all. I was looking for patterns and logic and the way that things were unfolding. And then I found this memorandum, which was each of these three men, who were all Republicans, all anti-slavery, made a copy for themselves and buried it in their confidential papers. And it was truly something remarkable. It was written in later years, looking back at the 1850s, which the latter chunk of my book looks at.
Yeah.
And they were recounting how humiliating and mortifying and disempowering it was to be anti-slavery and to have the Southerners attack and silence you and in all kinds of ways essentially shut you down and cut off in that way the full representation of your constituents. So the statement in describing that was so full of their emotion about that situation. Even years later, they've talked about, you know, the rage and the disgrace of it and that they could barely tolerate it. And then they talk about this rather dramatic decision that they make, that from now on, they're going to do what they need to do to shut down that kind of behavior. They're going to fight Southern style, and they're
yes.
going to be willing to duel with Southerners.
Yeah.
And it's a big deal decision, because Northerners don't approve it dueling by this point. And they say in the statement, we'll probably be ostracized for doing this. But being ostracized won't feel any worse than being in Congress and being humiliated this way and have our people be humiliated this day on a daily basis. And what brought tears to my eyes was partly the power of the memorandum, but also the end of it. Because at the end, they say, we're writing this statement not for the present, but for the future. We want future people to be able to read this and understand essentially what it felt like to fight for, I think they call it the cause of freedom, in Congress, in the highest institutions in our government. And it literally felt as though they were talking to me. They were literally saying, "This, you need to understand what this felt like. Someone in the future will see this and will understand what it felt like." And some part of me felt so moved and so moved first that they were thinking about addressing posterity in this way, and then that this story was literally on that paper essentially asking to be told.
Mm. Well, we have to talk about Benjamin Brown French.
Yes.
Who no one would have heard of until your book, I don't think anyway, not many. Let's talk about him because he's the witness that you choose to help us tell and lay out this story. He's a house clerk from New Hampshire.
Yes. And I would say you're absolutely right that most people will not have heard of him. Those few who have probably study Abraham Lincoln, because people who study Lincoln are very thorough in finding every mention of Lincoln that they can find. And French was involved in the Lincoln White House. So some people know of him for that specific connection. But most people don't know of him. And he was from a small New Hampshire town. He was made a clerk, not the clerk initially, but a minor clerk in Congress. And what was amazing about him was, first of all, he has an 11-volume diary.
Yeah.
It's an amazing diary.
Right.
And it's not a boring diary. So it's not the kind of diary that says, you know, it rained today, had lunch with Mr. Smith.
Yeah.
But he really writes about what he sees and what he thinks and what other people say and how it makes him feel. So in and of itself, the diary is an amazing, amazing document. And he also, even better, had a newspaper column,
right,
and he wrote poetry about politics.
Yeah.
So he's, as I was writing the book, I thought people are going to say I made this guy up, which I really didn't.
No, he's
but
great.
But he's amazing, and he's a very real character. He has a sense of some self-awareness to him. So he was fun to write about for that reason. But the thing that made him the sort of stellar witness that he ends up being is that at the start of the book, he's what would have been called a dough-faced Democrat at the time, and that means a Northern Democrat who was willing to do almost anything to appease the South, including stay silent on the issue of slavery. So he was someone who's kind of a jovial fellow, and he's liked by Whigs and Democrats and Northerners and Southerners, and all he wants to do is smooth things over and save the Union. And by the end of the book, he buys a gun in case he might need to shoot some Southerners.
Yeah.
And my thought was, if I can explain how this person, this seemingly good-natured person, moved from point A to point B over the course of a little more than two decades, that's really showing something about what I end up calling the road to civil war that hasn't really been explored before.
Yeah. You refer to him also as a professional history stalker. I mean, it's like he was a kind of Forrest Gump character. He was sort of everywhere at that time.
Exactly. That's exactly who he was. He is my own personal Forrest Gump. Yeah, he is. Someone tries to assassinate President Andrew Jackson. French sees it happen. John Quincy Adams has his stroke in the House of Representatives after his presidency. He goes back to Congress, and not long after he has the stroke, there's French holding his hand. Gettysburg Address being delivered. Who's up on the platform right near Lincoln?
Yeah.
Benjamin Brown French. And then the assassination. You know, who's at the bedside at Lincoln's assassination? But French is there. So, yeah, again, I thought people are never going to believe this. I better have lots and lots and lots of references to the diary to prove he's everywhere. He's self-aware and has this, you know, he's a clerk. His job is to record things. So he was pretty ideal.
So when he gets there, when he gets to Washington, and you tell the sort of how he makes his way there, but when he gets there, give us a sense of what Washington looked like and really smelled like, because you could say you could see and smell, I guess, the city's rawness pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, he came from a small town. He came from Chester, New Hampshire. It's where he was born. It's a small town. So he comes to Washington in 1833. And certainly compared to Chester, Washington seemed like the big city. And there's a letter from his father that basically says, you know, be careful of all the sins in the big city, my son, you know. But Washington was a new city and was very rough. There were a handful of government buildings and then a lot of sort of small wannabe buildings or much more primitive structures. The roads weren't paved. There were no street signs. There was livestock wandering all over on the streets. I mean, it was really, you know, more of a big town than a city. And it it had the feeling of a southern in flavor, but even so kind of new-ish town with weird pacing to it, because at certain times of year, much like Washington now, I suppose, it was busy, 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 and then it would sort of, people would leave and Congress would go home and it would sort of tamp down. As you noted, the smell. There was sometimes a stinky place too. There were pools of nastiness sort of around in different places in Washington. They were still kind of figuring out the best way to landscape different things in Washington, never mind the livestock meandering around too. So it's not what we expect Washington to be. I think we think of the age of Clay, Calhoun, and Webster as, you know, the noble civilized past. And in this period, it's not the noble civilized past in that kind of a way, and the status of Washington and all the tobacco spitting really reminds you that this is a different world.
Yeah. Well, these were not, it was a place, as you say, very human failings, a very human institution. Say something about the tobacco, because Charles Dickens was absolutely grossed out by this when he came here in 1842, I think it was.
And that's quite remarkable by modern standards. So Congress, as we've already suggested, is a representative institution in the roughness of it. And like, you know, parts of the city, it it smelled of many bad things, including body odor, tobacco juice, and any number of other nastiness. And it was hot and it was crowded. But the tobacco juice, Dickens comes to America and he very clearly asks to go see Congress. And the first thing he comments on in great detail is tobacco spitting. Apparently, I mean, there are a lot of British onlookers who visit America in this period and are all equally repulsed by tobacco spitting. But in Congress, you know, there are spittoons all over the place in the House and the Senate, but people don't always hit their mark. And so the rugs were pretty repulsive in this period. The remarkable thing about Dickens is that the other thing he asks about, so he sees the tobacco juice and is just repulsed. He asks to have two specific congressmen pointed out to him, and they are the two most violent congressmen. So he heard tales about Congress in this period, and he was asking, basically, he was a violence in Congress tourist.
Well, wasn't there a lot of that? I mean, it seems like, and this comes later when people, it's like going to a hockey game to watch a fight. There was a bit of that, it seems.
Well, for sure, you know, there was some degree of people came and sat in the galleries. People who lived in Washington came and sat in the galleries to watch the debates. And yeah, to some degree, if they expected some kind of a set to or a, you know, scuffle of some kind, they'd come explicitly to watch the action. You know, there are times when there's something particularly bad that happens one day, and the next day the galleries will be kind of crowded because people are wondering, ooh, is it going to be a follow-up? Like, what's going to happen today? So there is kind of a hockey component to it, and I think also along the same lines, you know, there's violence in hockey, but we don't expect people playing hockey to kill each other. And there's violence in Congress, but generally speaking, I don't think people expected congressmen to kill each other either.
Right. Congress, when French arrives and you start documenting all of this, had been in operation for something like 44 years. And so they had these systems in place. But you also say they were still working out the kinks. And it's interesting, newspapers. You talk about how newspapers at that time were paying most of their attention to what was going on in Congress. That oratory, for example, was kind of a popular form of entertainment at the time.
Very much, very much. And as I was marveling when I was writing the book, think about the attention span, right? This was like a popular amusement. You go and hear a speech and someone speaks for 2 hours and you sit there and listen to a 2-hour speech. This would not work today. When people are frustrated after, you know, 90 seconds. But yeah, that was a hugely popular form of entertainment in this period. And obviously congressmen would be very good at pontificating in that manner. And the press, too. I mean, the United States from its founding was always a very newspapered country. Newspapers were always central. The press was central. The founders assumed that the press would essentially act as a branch of government enforcing accountability. So the presence of it and the importance of it doesn't change. But in this period, with the government in Washington and conditions in America still relatively primitive, it was a big deal thinking about how news got from Washington to the nation, and it sometimes took time. So the book does talk about how in the certainly the early years in which it takes place, the 1830s, you know, the press in Washington was a handful of newspapers, a handful of newsmen. They would sit in the galleries or even sometimes on the floor and listen to debates and take notes and then go back and check with congressmen to see if they liked the version of the speech that they'd written down. And it was an insular thing, and it was a, you know, intimate thing, a small number of people. And the nation was really tuned in to congressional debate. Unless it was a presidential election year, a huge amount of the space in an average newspaper was devoted to Congress.
You describe it as a constant case of organized chaos. And it was so interesting. You really give a sense of the atmosphere, how that the acoustics were terrible. It was a stuffy place. It smelled bad in the chambers. But it's interesting how people learned how to kind of play to the bad acoustics.
Yes.
That was, but say something about that, how you sometimes you could hear people whispering from really far away, and you could also get into places where no one could hear you. I really loved this part of it.
Yeah. Well, so the acoustics were bad, but also strange.
Yeah.
So there was apparently some part of a gallery where if you whispered in that part of the gallery, somehow or other the sound would migrate down to the speaker in the House of Representatives. And so there's one occasion in which I think they call them the love whisperings of a couple up in the corner of the gallery makes it all the way down to the floor so that people can hear. Or in other cases, some sound comes from one part of the chamber and the speaker turns towards it to recognize the person, but actually the person speaking was from the other side of the chamber. So the acoustics were weird, and either the voices were bouncing all over the place or you couldn't be heard at all. And there's an account of someone who's in the galleries and watching what's going on, and he describes it as looking like a room full of people engaged in gymnastics because they're trying to wave their arms and move around and do whatever they need to do to be noticed and then to be heard.
And lots of alcohol. And we should point out, I mean, this was a time, as you say, that was this was an age of remarkably heavy drinking, pretty much every day, all day, all of the time. People were doing a lot of drinking. Say something about that and then mention the night session of 1835. Where the Democrats go crazy.
Yes. Well, so there, yes, I mean, in the United States, there was a lot of alcohol drinking in this period. So people were drinking all the time. Congressmen were no different. And in a way, they might have been worse because some of them certainly were living a bachelor life in Washington. When you look through diaries and letters of the period, you see descriptions of congressmen, you know, too drunk to stand, too drunk to leave their quarters where they're staying, or just, you know, giving some grand speech and actually being remarkably coherent considering how drunk they are. I think John Quincy Adams at one point sums up the performance of one speaker. He just writes in his diary, "Drunk in the chair." So, yeah, there was a lot of drunkenness, and that certainly helps the rowdiness. Evening sessions were particularly bad because congressmen would go out and have dinner. They would drink with dinner. They would come back. No one wanted to be there at night. If they're there at night, often it's a contentious issue being discussed. And so I can't say that every night session saw violence, but, boy, a lot of night sessions did see some form of violence.
One more thing about atmospherics before we move on, because I loved this detail of how one of the things that the people in the galleries were looking at and paying particular attention to were the heads of of the members of Congress. And this was heads were important in those times because of the pseudoscience of phrenology. That was kind of a thing then.
It was a thing that supposedly you could look at the shape of a person's head and judge different aspects of his character by feeling the size and space and, I don't know, bumpiness. I have no idea since I certainly have never studied phrenology. But it was a pseudoscience that you examine a person's head and that tells you about who they are. And so, yeah, there's a lot of quirky attention paid to people's heads. I mean, that's true in culture of the time, but also people who sit up in the galleries, you know, they remark to each other, my, did you see his head? So, yeah, it was another way in which people were literally trying to read their surroundings, and that was yet another form of evidence, I suppose.
Yeah. Joanne Freeman, she's a professor of history and American studies at Yale University. She co-hosts a history podcast called Backstory. Her new book is The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Want to take full control of how you give to KUER? If you're already a sustainer, you can sign up for MyKUER. You'll be able to update your contact and payment information, make changes to your monthly gift, and even leave us a message. Think of it like getting into the driver's seat. It's up to you where we go. Sign up for MyKUER at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about violence in Congress, actual violence, fistfights and guns and knives. We're talking about Joanne Freeman's new book. She's a professor of history at Yale University. It's called The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War. Benjamin Brown French is confessing to his diary his anxiety about the state of the country. And on December 10th of 1839, you write about that day in particular, how for French, he believed that his worst fears were playing out, that the place was in kind of a state of chaos. Talk about what's going on in December of 1839.
Sure. So I should say that French doesn't fret about every moment of violence, but he gets very concerned at the openings and closings of Congress.
Yeah, yeah.
If Congress can't open properly or can't close properly, he then really begins to worry about the structure of government and is it going to survive. So in the case that French is talking about, it involves the opening of Congress. There are elections which are being contested. There are people jumping to their feet and screaming, insisting that they are the people who have been legally elected for the seat that they have. And essentially, Congress can't organize, and it goes on, and there's howling and screaming. At one point, French says in his diary, he feared physical violence.
Right.
And he really feared, he actually says something along the lines of, years from now when people look back to the fall of the Republic, they'll look back to this moment and see that it was the start. He really, throughout his diary, pretty much from 1833 all the way until the Civil War, he's very wary about the state of the Union, and he thinks that really is being reflected in Congress.
He saw a lot of fighting, of course, a lot. But I want to get to a moment from 1838, because this one really stands out. This is a duel, an actual duel between a Maine congressman and a Kentucky congressman, Jonathan Silley from Maine, William Graves from Kentucky. And I want to kind of work through this. So I want to start here. This was one thing you talk about. I was thinking that in those days, Congress would often work very much like the animal world, in the sense that there was a lot of violence that was mostly for show, and mostly these were threats. And you say in the book that this Silley Graves story was not how congressional violence was supposed to work. And this is how you put it in the book. You say, once the initial flashpoint of conflict passed, friends and allies usually smoothed things over. Talk a little bit about this, because it was for show, but in the end, it could be kind of harmless.
Well, it was for show, but it wasn't. To say it was for show means, and you're right, that it's performative, And some of what they're doing is to, you know, demonstrate their power and someone else's weakness before their colleagues in Congress and before the nation at large. But that kind of humiliation, having someone stand up and silence you or bully you or humiliate you or insult you somehow in full public view, that has a power to it. I mean, that's part of what that initial statement that I found that brought tears to my eyes is testifying to the power of that. So on the one hand, they're not trying to kill each other, but they really are trying to humiliate, or to use the word they use all the time, degrade people to get them to shut up and sit down so that they can get their way. So it is for show. It's not for killing, but it's still very powerful. It's a really powerful mode of intimidation.
Well, you mentioned that a lot of this was grounded in the, as you put it, the gut-wrenching power of public humiliation. That was something that fueled a lot of these fights, I guess.
It fueled the fights, and it fueled self-censorship on the part of some Northerners who didn't choose to engage in that kind of a culture. So, yeah, Southerners and Southern-born Westerners were quicker to resort to kind of man-to-man violence, and they knew that the South was comfortable with dueling and that the North wasn't. And they use that to their advantage in Congress. So at some point in the book, I referred to it as the Northern Congressman's dilemma. Yeah. That, you know, what do you do if a Southerner stands up and bullies you or humiliates you or insults you in some way? Do you, you know, apologize and sit down, which is humiliating? Do you stand up to it, in which case you risk, I don't know, a dual challenge or fisticuffs on the street or something? Do you just never stand up in the first place and sort of let things go on without really saying very much, in which case you're silencing yourself and your constituents? Mm-hmm. So it was hard to know what to do. And for some Northerners, it shut them up. They backed down or they kept themselves silent, rather than come up against some of the particularly notorious bullies in Congress. And there were certain people in Congress who were known to be bullies. Yeah. I would guess that roughly 10% of any House, certainly, were people who were known to be fighters. And I write in the book about how at the beginning of a Congress, you know, certainly French looks around and kind of starts to detail the fighting history of the people in the chamber. You know, so that was a factor that you factored in a really concrete way into figuring out the dynamics of the floor.
Well, and as you say, these Northerners who had to really take into account whether or not they weren't just being silenced themselves. You were, as you say, silencing their constituents. And constituents expected you to fight, you say.
Well, in this period, they don't yet in the North expect their congressmen to fight. They do eventually. But in this early period, constituents want their congressmen certainly to defend their rights and their interests. But Northern constituents are not assuming that their congressman should be brawling. And even someone as powerful as John Quincy Adams, who kind of was afraid of nothing, there's a point in the book at which he ponders saying something to silence a Southerner, and then he stops because he says, if I do it, there's going to be a brawl, and then I'm going to be attacked as someone who prompts brawls, and it's not going to be worth it, so I'm just not going to say anything at all. So for a while, at least, Northerners definitely want to be represented and want their interests defended. But they're not eager to have their congressmen putting up their dukes or pulling out Bowie knives or pistols.
Well then, does this make this shows a distinction, I guess, between constituents in the South and in the North? Because there is a point at which, as you say, they were mailing pistols to their congressmen.
Late in the 1850s.
That comes later. Okay.
It's much later. In this early period, as you're suggesting, Southerners don't have a problem with their congressmen literally fighting for their interests. And as a matter of fact, very often fighting Southern congressmen get reelected. And this is a period when there's a real churning in and out and in and out of Congress. You know, a lot of people there are there for one term. So the fact that people are getting reelected is noteworthy. And the fact that fighting men get reelected is really noteworthy.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about this duel. What's interesting about this Cilley-Graves duel is that, as you put it, this wasn't caused by some outburst or simmering rivalry. They were pulled into this fight. Set this up for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I picked this fight to focus a chapter on, because I call it at one point the duel that no one wanted.
Yeah.
No one wants to fight this duel. No one wants it to happen. And yet it happens, and it ends up being tragic. So how does that make sense? You know, how do you end up having a duel that nobody wants actually happen? And so in this case, in the 1830s, a lot of the violence and fighting, physical fighting in Congress, was centered along party lines. So it was Whigs and Democrats. Mm-hmm. And this particular episode breaks out when a particularly flamboyantly prone to fight congressman from Virginia named Henry Wise comes into the House and suggests and waves a newspaper around, suggesting that the Democratic Party is corrupt.
Yeah.
And Cilley, who's a Democrat, stands up and protests and objects. And Wise, being Wise and someone who's very good at this kind of bullying, immediately turns to Cilley and says something along the lines of, "Are you suggesting I'm lying?
Yeah.
Is this personal?" At which point, bang, it's moved into duel territory.
Right.
And Cilley knows that. So there's an unpleasant moment. Wise ends up insulting Cilley and nothing really much comes of it. But the fellow who wrote the newspaper that had the attack on the Democrats, he gets insulted by Cilley in the course of that scuffle. And so he rides down from New York to Washington to find Cilley for himself and ask him about, confront him on the insult and potentially, once again, involve him in a duel.
Yeah.
So this fellow, James Watson Webb from New Yorker, who I should say is a fighting man's fighting man. You know,
right.
People referred to people in Congress as fighting men. This fellow, he was partly a military man and that helped. But he was, over the course of his career as an editor, he was like whipped and shot and kicked. And he was a violent person.
Yeah.
And known for wanting to fight duels with anyone who dares insult him as an editor. So he shows up in Washington. He asks someone who he's friendly with, William Graves of Kentucky, to deliver a letter to Cilley. And it was a letter of inquiry, which in an affair of honor, the first thing you do is you send a letter of inquiry saying, "I heard you said this about me. Did you say it? Did you mean it? Explain yourself."
Right.
So it's not a challenge. It's just kind of, you know, making the person aware that he has insulted someone and that now they might end up fighting a duel.
Yeah.
So Graves doesn't really know much about dueling and actually pauses before he delivers the letter and asks Webb, "This isn't a challenge, is it?" And Webb says, "No, no, no. If this were a challenge, I'd find somebody else. It's just a letter of inquiry." So Graves goes and delivers to Cilley this letter. When he says he has a letter to deliver from Webb, Cilley won't take it, because he doesn't want to deal with Webb. He doesn't want to confront him. He doesn't want to be – he doesn't respect him, and he certainly doesn't want to get involved in an affair of honor or a duel with him. So now you have these two men, Cilley and Graves, and they like each other fine.
Yeah.
They have nothing against each other.
Yeah.
But now they're in this situation where Graves feels kind of insulted, because by not accepting the letter, Cilley is kind of suggesting that Graves is, you know, hanging out with people of low character. And by the laws of honor, you know, if a person won't fight with the principal in a duel, then the second has to step into his place. So now you have this case in which they like each other. They don't want to fight each other. And they don't feel that they can turn around and walk out. And both men consult with any number of friends. What do I do now? I don't know what to do now, which is another reason why I decided to write about this. They look for all kinds of advice on what to do, and they're basically told, well, you know, you can't really back out. I mean, maybe it'll be a street fight instead of a duel, so you'd better, like someone says to Cilley, maybe it'll be a street fight instead of a duel, so go find a gun.
Yeah.
Because you better walk around with a gun in case something bad happens. So the congressional community kicks in and begins counseling these guys. And again, no one wants anything bad to happen. I think most people assumed in one way or another it would be smoothed over.
Right.
But one thing leads to another, and it isn't.
No. It February 24th, it takes place, finally. Had all these advisors with them, all these teams. It's interesting. This is how you put it in the book. You say it shows a group of men gingerly feeling their way through a deadly encounter, even when they're there, facing each other and using rifles, by the way. That was interesting. Did they do a lot of duels with rifles in those days?
Northerners didn't duel a lot. But when they did, they often preferred rifles because those were the kinds of guns they were most familiar with.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's one other duel that happened before the time that my book discusses that was a duel with a northerner and had a rifle in it. And so that's part of the logic there.
But it's so interesting the way – so there's this first exchange. Both men miss. And then their advisors get together in the middle and they try to work things out. And then they can't. And then there's a second exchange and they get together and try to work things out. But it's almost comical in some ways.
Right. Well, right. And that was one of the surprising things about researching this to me. So I've written a lot on dueling before, and particularly on the Burr-Hamilton duel. But, you know, I know about the rules, yeah. And I've studied any number of duels. But typically, you end up after a duel with very formal statements in which, you know, so-and-so met on the field at this time, and they both represented themselves honorably, and, you know, this shot and that shot, and then it ended. You don't get detail.
Yeah.
And because this ends up being a big deal because a congressman kills another congressman, there's a congressional committee that investigates it, and they call all these people in, anyone remotely involved or witnessing any part of it, into the room to testify before the committee. So we have the testimony of all of these people about what they assumed about dueling, about what they thought was happening at a given moment. So it's amazing, amazing evidence of a kind you really, really almost never get for a duel. And the idea that they're kind of gingerly feeling their way through is because they all admit at one point or another, hey, are we in Washington? I don't know if we're in Washington. Should we be doing this here? I don't know if we should be doing this here. You can see them desperately wanting this to not go badly, desperately wanting to follow the forms and functions of what they're supposed to be doing, and not really fully being confident in what they're doing and literally figuring it out one step at a time.
Does it become a turning point in some ways, this particular duel, this particular moment of violence?
Well, you know, John Quincy Adams wants it to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, John Quincy Adams says, well, there you go. You know, that's going to show you that, you know, he assumes that Cilley was a Northern Democrat trying to show Southerners what a brave and powerful Democrat he was and trying to prove to them that he's just like one of them. And, you know, Adams says, well, you know, this will show them Northerners that they, you know, shouldn't necessarily follow in those kinds of footsteps. I don't think it's a turning point.
Yeah.
And that's kind of remarkable if you think about the fact that one congressman kills another in a duel. You know, there's a sort of joking point in that chapter in which someone asks someone in a carriage that same question. Wow, you think this is going to really stop dueling in Washington? And the person basically responds and says, oh, I don't know. Give it 10 days or so.
Yeah.
Something else will happen. So it isn't. But it certainly is a noteworthy moment. And for French, it's a remarkably noteworthy moment because it's just not – you see in his diary the degree to which he's stunned that someone is killed. That's not what he expected.
Yeah.
The fighting, the violence, the humiliation, the implications, all of that he expects. But this went one step further, and the person who was killed was a New Englander, and French was very invested in what he calls Yankee honor, right? The honor of Cilley, the Yankee honor being upheld by Cilley. So it affects him on a lot of levels.
Yeah, you say it shook him to his core, that he couldn't ever get over it.
Yeah. I mean, even so, he writes about it again and again and again in his diary. He goes to the dueling ground and sketches what it looks like. He writes in the newspaper about it. And then years later, when he plays around with writing a memoir, the thing that receives the most coverage is the Grave Cilley duel.
Let's talk about the Congress of 1855, or around this time, actually, because we'll talk about 1856, too. The House elects this anti-slavery northerner as speaker, Nathaniel Banks of Massachusetts. And I'm wondering, it seems like things are just headed towards even more chaos. And this kind of gets us to this incident in May of 1856, the caning of Charles Sumner.
Right.
Let's talk about that, because you mentioned that this particular moment wasn't shocking only because it was violent. But
right.
You write that it was the nature of the violence.
Right.
That was so, I guess, noteworthy.
The nature of it and the context of it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So by the time you get to the mid-1850s, you have a long stretch of time in which Northern congressmen are not fighting back against bullying Southerners.
Yep.
You have a really intensifying slavery problem, which is very rapidly reaching some kind of a head, and both North and South know it, and so the stakes are exceedingly high. And you finally, after a time, begin to have the rise of a Northern explicitly anti-slavery party, the Republican Party. When I was writing the book, what was fascinating was, you know, looking at the context and the rhetoric with which the Republican Party came to be. Certainly, historians have long known that the Republicans ran on the idea that they would fight what they called the slave power. Like, right. We are a new party and we shall fight the slave power. Well, one of the things that I discovered in researching the book is that that has a very literal meaning in Congress. They are there alongside these people who are trying to silence and humiliate them, and they have to decide what to do and if they're going to fight and how will they fight. And so the beginning when you start to have numbers of Republicans in Congress, the violence in Congress really peaks. So certainly that's part of what happens before the very famous, actually the most famous violent incident in Congress, which happens in 1856, the caning of Sumner. The other thing that happens before that is that there are a string of violent incidents of Southerners attacking Northerners on the street. There's someone who's attacked on the street. There's a Southern-born California congressman who kills a waiter at the Willard Hotel. Yeah. There's a series of incidents in which it's very clear that Southerners are acting out against Northerners physically, violently. So that's part of the setup for the caning of Sumner is it's not just one incident. It appears to be part of a trend, and it's part of a seemingly very alarming trend. So that's part of what makes it such a big deal. The other thing that makes it such a big deal, as you suggest, is not just because it's violent, although the violence matters. It was particularly brutal.
Yeah.
But it's the way that the violence played out, the way that it was inflicted. Normally, if a congressman wanted to deliberately stage an assault, as opposed to erupting on the floor and punching someone, he would do that out on the streets of Washington. And street fights were, in the book, I call them a kind of northern duel.
Yeah.
That you would expect if you insulted someone, and it's very clear you're not going to fight a duel, that probably you'll have a street fight. So this sort of assault that Preston Brooks of South Carolina stages against Charles Sumner, abolitionist in Massachusetts, for insulting the South, insulting South Carolina, insulting some of Brooks's kinsmen. What he does for the first 2 days after the insults is he stays on the grounds of the Capitol trying to catch Sumner when he's going into or coming out of the building because he knows that's the proper way to do this kind of attack.
Yeah.
He knows that if you stage this kind of a deliberate assault in the House or Senate chambers, it becomes something very public and very official in a way that it wouldn't if it happened on the street. And eventually he loses his patience and says, oh, to heck with it. I'm just going to go in there and find him.
Yeah.
So then it takes on this added meaning that you have a member of the House from South Carolina who stalks into the Senate, Sumner sitting at his desk, actually franking copies of the speech that he delivered that so upset Brooks. And Brooks tells him, you've insulted me, you've insulted the South, you've insulted my kinsmen, and I have to act on that, and begins to violently cane Sumner.
Yeah.
And the desks were bolted to the ground. So Sumner can't just pull away. He's kind of stuck. In the end, he is so desperate to get away that he wrenches the desk, bolts and all, out of the floor. But Brooks really assaults him violently and until his cane breaks, really. And Sumner is badly wounded, although amazingly, as he's being taken out of the chamber, he's brought to someone's home nearby. And one of the first things he sort of gasps out is, I hope this is going to be good for the anti-slavery cause.
Yeah.
You know, he's still thinking that, okay, you know, barbaric South, this is the ultimate display of the barbaric South. Maybe it will be good for something.
Talk about the reaction to all of this, because it seems like the reaction to this, we start to get to the point at which we start to see Congress being depicted, certainly in the press, as the great national circus. And I'm wondering what the reputation of Congress, what becomes of that, and the sense of trust then between the public
right.
and Congress.
Right. Well, so one of the things that happens in the lead up, the years before the Sumner caning, is that the telegraph has come along,
right,
and is spreading news more quickly and more in a more widespread manner than ever before. So interestingly, kind of like social media today, mm-hmm. a new technology comes along and scrambles things. So news is spreading more rapidly and in a more widespread manner than ever before. And you also have, particularly in this period, New York City newspapers are really becoming major movers and shakers in the press world. But generally, overall, as the slavery problem heats up and as the question of Kansas and its admittance to the Union as a slave state or a free state becomes a bigger and a bigger deal, you have pro-slavery and anti-slavery newspapers threading conspiracy theories through their newspapers, each claiming that the other side is doing something underhanded and sneaky to take control of the Union away. And those theories have a power to them. You know, those theories are believable to people, so that in later years, when you get into the 1850s, the mid-1850s, those have been in play for a while, and people are really beginning to distrust the other side, I suppose you could call it. They're othering each other pretty aggressively, and they're beginning to really wonder about the motives of the other side, including French, who, you know, by the time we get towards the end of the book, is deeply distrustful of Southerners.
Yeah. And what did this mean in a larger sense? I want to read something you write in the book. You said, by performing warfare in the halls of Congress during a crisis of the Union, congressmen gave human form to the fraying of national bonds. In the process, they stoked the flames of disunion. I guess the broader implication, at least that I took from this, is that the country itself, people were taking their cues from what was going on in Washington, mm-hmm. that mattered.
Right. And vice versa.
Yeah,
I think at some point in the book, I call it a cycle of outrage,
yeah.
in which you have congressmen who are howling away to defend the interests of their constituents. You have the press playing up the howling and the fighting to make a point to support their cause. You have the public reading about it and wanting more of it because they want their cause defended and sending that message back. And so you really do have this sort of a cycle. You have it's feeding in on itself, that people are taking their cues from Congress and Congress is taking its cues from the demands of the people. And all of them are at this point where they're feeling that the stakes are desperate and almost anything is worth doing at this moment, because the country now, it might be deciding the fate of slavery forever. And will the South be eliminated as a power in the nation? Will slavery be inflicted on the North? People really do feel that it's a turning point, a political turning point in the course of the nation. And so for that reason, too, a lot of what's unfolding in this period, joined in with those conspiracy theories, begins to seem really, really momentous.
Was it ever as bad again?
Well, it's a good question. You know, when I was writing the book, I knew that I was going to probably take it up to the Civil War. I wondered what happened when the Southern congressmen secede, mm-hmm. you know, leave the hall.
Yeah.
But people always ask that very question. What happens to the violence? Well, for one thing, it goes to the Confederate Congress.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So some of the Southerners who are fighting in the National Congress, they go to the South and they keep fighting there. So some of this is cultural, for sure.
Yeah.
But basically, when the South comes to try to get back into the Union, when you begin to have, you know, the war coming to a close and you begin to have Southern states wanting to come back into the Union, when Southerners show up in Washington and come to the Capitol as part of the delegations to make these requests, they bring violence back with them.
Yeah.
But the dynamics has changed so dramatically that it doesn't have the impact that it had before, by far. So, you know, there's one particular instance in which a Southerner canes a Northerner within the walls of the Capitol, not in the House or Senate chamber, but still. And like with the Brooks Sumner incident, he brings two friends. And like with the Brooks Sumner incident, he has they're armed. I think Brooks had two men with canes with him, and this fellow brings two men with guns. So it's even kind of an uptick in the violence. But this happens, and rather than doing what happened with the Sumner caning, which is inflaming the nation and causing an even more extreme feeling, Northerners basically say, do we want these barbarians back? Do we really want these barbarians back? There's actually a congressman who stands up and says, do you all remember what it was like here in the 1850s? Let's just pause and consider what this means. The Northerners are in power now. They're culturally in power. They're mm-hmm. politically in power. And that really changes the dynamics dramatically.
Let me just tack on a postscript here, because I think, and you referred to it earlier, what Benjamin Brown French thinks of all of this. The United States, he says, is no longer to be triumphed over as if it were a coward and dared not protect itself. So where he comes around, where he's kind of ambivalent about fighting, is in the end, as you said earlier, he's ready for a fight.
He is. He is. And you see that happen over the course of the book. And you see that happening as he grows to distrust Southerners.
Yeah.
Oh, so he, in over time, he sees that if the Southerners are given a choice between supporting the Democratic Party or supporting themselves and the South, they always opt for the latter. And eventually that begins to have an impact on French's career, so that he can't put it by anymore. He has to actually deal with it. So he begins to really, really deeply distrust Southerners. And over time, like many another Northern Democrat, French migrates his way into the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And then once he's there, he's seeing the string of violent incidents of Southerners against Northerners. And as I suggested at the outset, there's an amazing diary entry in which he discusses how people are being Northerners and Republicans are being attacked in the streets. And so he felt the need to arm himself. And he says in the diary entry, so I went into town today and I bought one of those little guns that you can keep on your person at all time, because if they're going to attack us for our ideas, I want to be armed at all times. And what's wonderful about the entry is it's tempting when you look at history to highlight the standout moments, and they are so apparently all capital letters, history happening, you know, like here is a historical moment. And this diary entry and what comes next is a real reminder that history happens in the dailiness of life. You know, it unfolds in the mix of everything else,
yeah.
And it's not separate from life. So he says, I went out to buy a gun, and when I first read that, I thought, wow, this is the best story. And then he says, I also bought 3 pairs of underwear, $1 a pair, and I have a pair on now, and they're really comfortable. Which I couldn't wait till I got to the point in the book where I got to put that quote in, because it so captures the fact that you can have extraordinary things happening in the absolute routine dailiness of life, and they're bound up together, and they're not pulled apart. They're really all part of life. They're one and the same. So that's a great example of doing historical research and of the way history unfolds. But yeah, so he's armed and he's ready now, if he needs to defend himself with a weapon.
Yeah, that's such a great story. Joanne Freeman, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. You know, it's a weird thing to have written a book about extreme polarization and othering and distrust between parts of the nation against each other and in institutions of government right now.
Yep.
If nothing else, you know, I sort of hope that understanding the past will make people really aware of potential threats in the present.
Joanne Freeman. She's a professor of history at Yale University, co-hosts a history podcast called Backstory. Her book is called The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.